Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Mercy Grace. Mercy is the co-founder and CEO of Panobi, and previously was a partner at Lightspeed Ventures and the first head of product at Slack, where she ran the growth team. Welcome, Mercy.
Hi, great to be here.
I'm so excited to have you on the show. You've learned so much building products, fundraising. Growth is a discipline. I feel like we're going to run out of time, but first, I think it's really valuable. Give people a bit of context. How do you like to summarize your story so far, the Mercy story?
Yeah, it changes sort of like at each epoch of my career, but lately I've really been reflecting on the fact that I've had the opportunity to play really every position on Team Startup, and I'm a startup junkie. I just love it. It's so much fun to work with small groups of people, invent new things. So I'm on my second venture-backed company now, but the first one where I'm a CEO, which is as cool as I thought it would be. I really love it. It's fun. It's been my curiosity and my desire to win has really been what's driven this sort of like multi-class career that I've been really lucky to have. So leading up to Panobi, if we sort of go in reverse, before this, I was a partner at a Sand Hill Road firm called Lightspeed Venture Partners. We had something like, I want to say, $8 billion AUM, or assets under management. A large firm with practices in China and India, multi-stage investing. And I learned so much there. And it was, as someone who had raised venture capital by the time I got into that position and having been at these different levels, it was incredible to be backstage, like backstage Silicon Valley, where, you know, acquisitions happen, CEOs get hired and fired. Yeah, it was great. And I earned the opportunity to have that role because of my work at Slack, where I was about the 50th full-time hire. I joined with a remit from the founder, Stuart Butterfield, who I had, you know, in classic Silicon Valley story time, known for 10 years because we had shared investors in previous companies where we were both founders. And I took the company Slack from 500,000 daily active users to over 6 million in less than 3 years. And by the time I left, my growth team was 50 people, whereas I joined the company at 50 people. So a real rocket ship. And those experiences, founder, PM, game designer, venture capital investor, and board member, really afforded me this unique vantage point, which is how I have ended up here as the CEO of Panobi, a platform that's really built to help people understand really like how to turn those tactics into strategy and how to continue to, you know, level up how you're thinking about growth and product and marketing and how everything comes together for the customer.
I love that you mentioned having done some game design. I'm biased because I also did some game design in previous life and occasionally dabble in it. It's a thread I find in product leaders over time. Yeah, I have Stuart, who, as you mentioned, like was trying to make a game. And then when that didn't work out, they're like, well, maybe we should try this chat thing.
Yeah, twice.
Yeah, twice, because Flickr was that too. And I have this pet theory that that it's a nice practice field for learning a lot of product skills.
I think that's right, yeah. And games really has a focus. Part of what's so incredible about making games is that it's a focus just on the fact that feelings are what drive our action. You know, oh, I feel scared of this boss, I'm going to run. I feel prepared for this puzzle. You know, I feel excited about this world, I'm going to go explore it. And it's just about having fun and really engaging someone's like imagination and seeing them lean into the screen and see their eyes light up when they're having fun. And so it's kind of product at its most pure in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and especially like the growth part of product, or what I would call like product-led growth, where the way people remember how they felt about the thing when they tried it. And that's going to be, even though it's difficult to measure, we don't have the EKG leads to try to detect the emotional state, but that's a huge input, right? In whether or not people stick with your product. So
yes, Yeah.
Let's dig into that growth topic. A theme through your career, a theme through tech itself, has been the rise of growth teams. And so you mentioned 2015, you joined Slack, starting with, you know, Slack's 50-person company, which compared to its size now, or even when you left, small. And then through that time, at that time in 2015, as far as I know, most startups didn't have an explicit growth team. Like, growth was obviously an important thing we all wanted, but of course, aren't we all part of the growth team? We're all trying to grow the business. Why would we be doing things at a startup if we're not trying to grow the business? Mm-hmm. But now it's a common model, especially in startups, especially once you've hit product market fit. So for those in the audience who haven't worked with like kind of a modern growth team yet, how do you describe and outline like kind of the typical mission and structure that startups use for growth teams today?
Growth teams, they're actually pretty similar, I think, to the product management practice at tech companies, because they really form to fill the shape that you need based on the technology and the customer and the acquisition channels that you're using and, you know, what the cadence of buying or growing that product is like. And that is part of what's challenging and fun about building products for them, is that the first person to work on growth at a company, you know, in my case, was a former game designer, product manager, and at another company, it's likely to be a marketer who's really great at even, you know, performance demand gen, which is basically buying ads at an ROI positive basis on the internet. And so much about growth really is the shared responsibility of everyone. I mean, you know, if you really go all the way up, it's the point of capitalism. It's like definitely the point of venture-backed companies is to grow and to exit the atmosphere at a certain speed. And when Stuart Butterfield and I, the CEO of Slack, were talking about, hey, we have this one team, and in that team, we called ourselves actually at first the new user experience team, or new XP. And that was my title when I joined, and I came in and I got some light instrumentation going on our front end to understand the funnel. And then I started redesigning our onboarding alongside some incredible people there, including Stuart himself, who's very involved in that process. And we were thinking about it as a way to like, hey, this is the entry point of the product. It's actually the only part of the product that everyone of your customers will see, you know, and it's like, it's a funny and kind of revealing way to think about it that way. And so our setup was very much focused on, you know, the activation of those teams and taking them through the product discovery to the point of paying. And then a lot of people who don't even think of themselves as a member of a growth team are members of the marketing team. And it's that handoff, and this is why they're so cross-functional, it's that handoff between, hey, is your positioning and the channels that you're using to reach people and how you're measuring what a valuable user is, it does that square up with the value that your product produces for its customers, really who your ICP, you know, or ideal customer profile is, and the metrics that are going to drive revenue. So if you're trying to get in, you know, a bunch of 14-year-olds on iOS, like you're driving that traffic, but your actual buyer is, you know, a 30-year-old woman who lives in an urban environment, like, right, you've done the wrong thing for growth. And so they are sort of these like custom teams, but there, I think, are a lot of best practices about the way to get some base rate understanding of the type of growth team your product and company need. And the fact, too, that everything leads to growth. It's the most, you know, cross-functional, no matter like where it starts, it ends up being the most cross-functional team and absolutely a shared responsibility across every org at the company.
That's part of why I find it interesting from an organizational design standpoint. It's similar to product management. I talked to a common question I'll ask for folks who have been, you know, either built product management orgs or been senior in a product management org, founders, how they think of that as when they're designing your organization, because obviously in you get coached when you're talking about organizational design and how you set up your teams. You want to give accountability to orgs, and you want to make sure it's clear who owns what and things like that. But then you have, and which is, you know, straightforward for, say, engineering, and then maybe not so straightforward for something like growth or product. So I find this, like, sometimes growth or similarly product manager, sometimes growth might report to the CEO, maybe to product, maybe to marketing. Do you, in your mind, is the correct structure for setting up these teams, you know, as someone who for Panobia, I assume, have been interviewing many people who have been working on these growth teams, you've been seeing a lot of different ways that, you know, some of the ways it's working, some of the ways it's not working for people building these teams out. Is there, like, you know, good and bad ways of setting these teams up? Or is it kind of like you say, based on the strengths and weaknesses of the company, where it is today, the right solution for doing that, the right structure just evolves depending on every single org, and it's kind of just bespoke?
I think that there are sort of like right and wrong ways to set up orgs based on their stage. So a common failure point that I'll see with an early stage startup. So let's say there are 25 people, maybe you've raised a Series A, you have a sense of product market fit and the channels that are working for you. That is a great time to hire a product manager. And it's an even better time to promote someone who already works at the company. Hmm. Deeply knowing your customer, caring about them, and actually also this kind of like unknowable thing until you've been through it, is having great relationships with other people who you work with because of that cross-functional responsibility. So a failure mode that I'll see is a 20-person company will hire a product manager from Instagram. And that's not a slag on Instagram at all. Obviously, iconic company, great growth, and, you know, continuing to innovate and get into new markets and find new customers. But the job of a product manager who's working on growth at Instagram is to stand in front of these time and scale tested, incredible internal tools, reach quietly toward a small knob and just turn it a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? And that's, I mean, that's its own practice. That's its own skill set, and probably its own background. But you don't have anything like that at a 20-person startup. So you're doing both yourselves and, frankly, that PM from Instagram a disservice to take them. And then, you know, to speak for my own experience at Slack, you know, I was that PM. No one was working on growth. My, you know, first week at the company, I ask, hey, so how's the funnel looking? You know, like, who's doing any work on it now? And they're like, the what? And I'm like, the front end, you know what? It's cool. Like, that's my job, you know, because I'm so used to startups. So I literally just went and bought Mixpanel, mm-hmm. had an engineer install it on the site, and we had our first funnel from that. But someone who has been at an at-scale company, even though their resume is so attractive, because you look at Instagram and you're like, yeah, I want that, you know, as the founder, it actually is the wrong choice versus an engineer, a data scientist, a marketer, or a PM, like, it can be really anyone who is like an impact-obsessed individual and scrappy as hell. Like, they are the person who is just going to go buy Mixpanel. They're not going to sit there complaining about not having data. They're going to go find that data and start using it to great effect. But then, of course, like, that person will either scale up over time or move back into something like a core product role once you are at the point where you have this sort of machine for growth. And it is about these small iterations and less about big bets.
I love that. But I'm also biased towards liking that story because many times over the years, I've been the person that have been asked some question and people are like, what do you mean? And I'm like, this is ridiculous. And I'm pulling in Mixpanel or whatever the tool is. So
yeah,
of course, I like that as a good thing to do. But, you know, that's one of the things I think we both probably love about startups is that there's big opportunities for impact there that you can come in and turn those dials. So some growth teams and maybe people who are not on the growth teams view of how growth teams think about the world as sometimes being, well, certainly as very data-centric, but then sometimes there's this idea that, oh, are they too data-centric? Or are they turning knobs? Or are they pushing, you know, if there's this focus on onboarding or maybe engagement or churn or whatever, they pick two or three metrics. And then they can focus overly on a number, but then lose sight of what it is like, as we were talking about, to the feeling of using the product. And so, yeah, some number goes up for now, but people are starting to resent it or whatever. Sort of, does that resonate with you, or is it just a misconception? Yeah.
No, that's the reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the term growth hacker became like, first, ooh, growth hackers, you know, and then I was like, ugh, growth hackers.
Great, I'm getting growth hacked. Look at the, more emails inbound, right? Are there any sort of approaches or mindsets or tricks that you have seen growth teams use to try and keep a damper on that, in terms of obviously trying to have that impact, but you want to have, of course, a whole company scale impact and not just turning the numbers? Is there any other approaches that help with aligning those?
Yeah. So actually, speaking to the data, making sure that you're not over fixated on kind of like the knob that you're turning. So a classic kind of failure mode is you have a marketer and a product manager. The marketer owns the website, and his job is to drive traffic and get them to click on one button to sign up. And then, you know, the product manager, her job is to take those people who clicked on that button and, you know, get them through the sign up funnel and to, you know, realize the value of the product. And in growth parlance, we call that activation. So in an org structure, the, you know, head of marketing or the head of growth who's setting these two people up, typically will be setting them up to fail and to sort of like miss the forest for the trees when the marketer is only focused on, you know, the rate of landing page conversion, mm-hmm. and the PM is only focused on the rate of activation. You have to continue to check in with the rest of the life cycle of your user and the performance of, you know, the rest of the product, like features or the number of people who are converting from what we call a product qualified lead, or PQL. So someone who's using the product and has sort of like hit the tripwire of like, hey, like they seem like they're getting it and they're using it and they're engaged with the product, over into, you know, converting them to paid. So I'm a huge fan of giving teams like that a single goal, and ideally one that's like further down the funnel, that represents, hey, and you're still adding dollars to revenue, or you're still focused on retention, and not just 30-day retention, but 6-month retention and 12-month retention. So that's one thing, right, is to make sure that you're giving people shared goals, that you're not kind of divide and conquering, so that people suffer further down the funnel. If like, hey, you're sending a bunch of, you know, garbage leads, like how am I going to convert those? And then the other thing is to keep people sort of radically in touch with the fact that you're building a product for human beings, you know, to the extent that you are, and that like that's your customers, not, you know, parrots with iPhones or something. Like, it's a person on the other end of that. And so bringing in qualitative aspects, so making sure to consistently do usability studies, and the thing that everyone pretends that they do and most people don't, which is talk to a customer, have a live conversation with them, and talk to sales and people on go-to-market, like customer success, because they are the people who are hearing from people who are a great fit, companies that are a great fit for your product, who have decided, nope, I reject you. And they often have concrete reasons to share with you as well. And that's the thing that can be so challenging about growth, is while at the same time you do need to execute flawlessly on these small things like experiments, you still need to be able to gain elevation and make sure that 6-month retention isn't dropping and you're processing, you know, product feedback from the sales team, and it's making it either, you know, into usability changes that the growth team owns or new features that core product is working on.
Yeah, I like that idea of, I think there's a bit of a, I don't call it a meme, but this idea that usability and growth hacking are in tension with one another, and that you have like, you know, some team going and doing usability improvements, and then there's the growth hackers making it worse by popping up more stuff. And, it, you know, the people put these joke screenshots on social media where their first time user experience has 18 different pop-ups all begging you for different things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But if you're focusing the, keeping the growth team aligned with your 6-month retention, then all of that garbage on the screen and all of these usability problems are probably, assuming that they actually are, in fact, usability problems, are, should impact negatively that metric. So I like the idea of of creating that loop where usability and growth are part of the same mindset rather than opposing teams.
Yeah.
Another metric that's like one of the ones that are close to my heart, so I like the idea of kind of poking on a little bit and see if you have anything thoughts on it, is application performance. Obviously, you know, retention and activation of new users is like classic metrics. You know, you don't need to have a growth team before you're like looking at those numbers. But one of the things that I think there's been maybe a resurgence of, you know, in our industry is a bit of cultural debate, I guess, about how obsessed we should be about performance. You know, you have, you know, these studies from 10, 20, 30 years ago saying that if you load your product and it loads in 100 milliseconds instead of 1,000, that can have a huge impact on how people feel about the product, and that can show up in your conversion rates and all of your metrics and long-term satisfaction. And yet we have these things where websites are megabytes large and it takes forever to even load and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Do you see, like, how do you see performance as, do you see that as like kind of an engineering owned thing? And I'm getting way into the weeds here. It's just like my own personal interest. But do you see that as an engineering owned thing? Or is that part of like a growth team, you know, growth teams running well, or are they also kind of like part of that conversation of pushing on things like that?
Yeah, I mean, we're back to pulling a strand on the interconnected web of growth, because performance is, you know, absolutely the domain of the engineering team. They are responsible for it, and also, like, they know how to improve it. But the growth team should be collaborating with them and making sure to keep an eye on things like load time, and to do even, you know, regression analysis to understand, are there, you know, areas of the world where we know that we're slower, and do we think that that is a reason why, you know, activation or expansion is lower there. You know, it's funny because those studies are old, but throughout the course of the last 30 years, we have DDoSed our attention spans.
Yeah.
Right? Like, man, if you thought lag killed, you know, like when it was like biddy biddy, you know, modems.
Yeah,
you know?
It took like a minute to even connect to the internet.
Exactly. It's like in the era of like TikTok and, you know, everything is 10 seconds. Yeah, it's, I think, even more important.
100 milliseconds matters even more now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'd be curious if you could find that effect. You know, maybe that's something worth searching. But my instinct is the same as yours. I bet it's measurable.
Yeah, and I wonder, you might even have to take it into like a lab environment, because part of the problem with lag is sometimes it's caused by the instrumentation that you put into the site,
yeah.
Right? Like you're loading yet another thing, you know, the API, you know, from Google Analytics has like stalled out, or you've been rate limited or something like that. And then you're actually blind, and you're not even like getting any data from it because like that didn't load, right? And so I think it is a little bit more of something that maybe you would have to like measure qualitatively, but I think it is something that we do know is true.
There's a bit of a fiendish problem where you get growth teams, whether or not they're called that, but people focused on growth have a bit of a tendency to want to install more and more tools into more and more analyzers and trackers and things to better understand the impacts of the work that they're doing and run experiments, which tend to have performance consequences, which tend to slow things down, but slow things down after they start recording data. Because necessarily,
exactly.
Right? I'm not sure what the solution to that other is than rather just having a good critical eye to that.
It is talking to people. And so it's funny because we call data collection and, you know, aggregating, anonymizing data, we call it quantitative analysis. And then we call user research and customer development qualitative analysis. But we're sort of alighting over the fact that your body is a sensor and your brain is a computer, and we have evolved to understand the meaning of a slight movement of a facial muscle,
yeah,
or a small change in a tone of voice. And so actually, like, the cumulative like outcome that you get from a conversation with person and understanding whether they leaned back when they said something or crossed their arms or frowned a little bit or stopped making eye contact, like, those are all, that's data. It's just that you're synthesizing it as you go and, you know, spitting out the outcome, which is like they do not like me, or like, hey, they love it.
Yeah, and then we have all those instincts then go into how we're interacting and how we're feeling about other things, such as your laggy product.
Yeah, exactly.
So the topic of the show is building products and teams. And so my instinct always is to go in and ask a whole bunch of things about setting up teams for building products. But a prerequisite for building especially ambitious products is capital. And you have an amazing perspective into this, having both led funded startups and been a VC yourself. So I'm legally obligated to ask you some questions about this at one of the top VC firms, no less. So you've mentioned the idea when we were talking previously about the, like a marauder's map to venture, which I think is particularly interesting to people because when you're on the outside, especially if you've never raised funding before, it can seem very mysterious. There's lots of horror stories. And so you sort of dread the entire thing. Tell me about this map and where can I buy a copy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I hand out copies of this map to people all the time because...
Excellent.
Yeah, I think people should know. It's a lot more efficient, basically, if people like really understand what they're getting into. And I'm a customer-obsessed person. And when I'm in fundraising mode or another founder is in fundraising mode, they're kind of your customer in the way that you're kind of their customer. And you need to understand the vantage point that they see you from. You know, you're kind of mutually buying each other's products, even though the capital is going in one direction. Have been, you know, pretty motivated especially because my first time raising venture capital was a pretty terrible experience. I mean, like a lot of people, and it's like, of course it was. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. I was like 22 or 23, you know, no business really getting the opportunity that I had. And it's amazing that I was able to raise a seed and a Series A. And even though I wasn't the CEO, I was in all of those conversations, and it was a shared effort. It was tough in part because I just didn't understand the things that I understand now, having been a VC. And so I have some quick tips if you want to.
Please hit us.
Rattle through
save
it.
Us, right. Save us from your pitfalls.
So I think, you know, one of the starting points for a fundraising process is to understand your position as the founder, and typically the CEO or the CEO and the CTO. So that is the fact that like the founder is in control. You have control of who you talk to. You have control of the timing. And even though you're nervous and like you want, you know, Kleiner to invest, you want Sequoia to invest, inhabiting the confidence of knowing that you have something really valuable is this crazy unlock. And it sort of puts them in a position that they're actually like quite comfortable with, which is a clear understanding of when are you going out to raise money? What milestones did you use to sort of get to that decision? And it can't be because we're out of cash in 3 months. It's like, you've already, don't bother going out for money. Start talking to people about winding down the company if it's 3 months, or like trying to find a soft landing for your team. But always run a process. And it is a process that you should control and approach it like you would any sort of like other program. When I was at Lightspeed, I had the opportunity to invest in Andrew Lee, who had been one of the founders of Firebase. He was the CTO, which sold to Google and became the Firebase that everyone knows. And he's an engineer. And so it was as if his fundraising process, because he was an old hand at that point, as if he had written a program and and he was executing it. And it was like, you know, I was trying to interrupt it to get ahead of other people and to short circuit things. And he was just running his process. It was awesome to see. And it also, it gives you confidence as an investor because that's the CEO. Like they should have a lot of executive function and be able to take something as amorphous as fundraising and really like grapple it and run with it. And so it starts with doing research on funds. So going to their websites, and if more people did this, I wouldn't have to include it in the Marauders map, but you may be surprised. So, you know, going to the venture capital websites, looking at specific partners, looking at their LinkedIn, understanding, okay, this is someone who has blogged about the section that I'm building in. They seem like, you know, oh, they were at Amazon working on AWS and I'm an infra founder, this is good. You know, like that is the person who would be both interested in me. They would have a prepared mind about the segment that I'm building in, and they'll be leaned in. Because what you're looking for, oddly, is not to convince people that what you're building has legs or is interesting, but it is actually to find the people who already are interested.
I've heard this advice before, which was kind of a mind-blown moment, but then also in some ways freeing. It's like, isn't it so much, wouldn't it be so much more pleasant to just go through a process trying to identify people who are already bought in on your thesis, which, you know, if you're a founder, you believe strongly enough that you've already jumped into yourself. You're probably not just going to 180 because some investor's like, oh, well, I don't think AI has any merit or whatever. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's like, that's really important. And that's free, you know, that's you and a spreadsheet and, you know, hours of your time for sure, but the best probably 10 hours that you'll ever spend. And if you are lucky enough to be in a community of people who have also raised money, take the other founders out to like a coffee or a drink and get the tea on, okay, like who insisted on these last minute ridiculous terms? Like, which firms should I look out for? Because you absolutely want the culture of your company and the values of you and your co-founders to be shared by the firm. I think it can be an uncomfortable fit if that isn't the case, because there's all kinds of like kind of different outcomes that happen from venture that you won't have any sort of like insight into.
Yeah.
So like really like owning and running that process. There's a lot about what it's like to be a VC that was, you're totally blind to unless you've been one or unless you've been like an EIR and you've had the opportunity, and that's an entrepreneur in residence. So you often get, you know, to hang out for like 3 to 6 months and work on an idea. And as part of that, you get to meet other founders and sit in on partner meetings. And that's where a lot of, you know, things get investment decisions are decided, you know, updates from the portfolio company are shared. It's really fascinating. You know, I think like when I was, of course, you know, 22, 23 year olds, they all seemed the same to me. All of these like venture capital firms seemed the same. And there's a saying, I don't know where it comes from, but the axe forgets and the tree remembers.
Right.
And I remember I was pitching some guy, you know, when I'm 23, and he was on his, got it, must have been a trio.
Yeah.
On his trio the whole time. It was like our second or third meeting, and he came in and he didn't even seem to recognize us, you know? And I was like, dude, F this guy, he sucks, you know? And then, you know, later I have this kind of flashback and I am in my 8th meeting of the day.
So this is before you were a founder, now you're a VC.
Yes. And now I'm a VC, you know, 12 years later, I'm a VC sitting on the other side of the table, realizing, oh, I have met this person before, or, you know, like, and I totally forgot. And I'm like, yeah, I see, you know, I see and meet so many founders. And like, when you're really doing the job of an investor, you're meeting people constantly, you're researching things constantly, and you are always having these kind of pretty transactional first dates with a huge number of people, and you just really don't retain, you know, and it's not special to you in the way that it is to them, because like they're going to remember when they pitched Sequoia, but for you it was Tuesday, and they may have honestly been like the 8th or 5th or 12th company that you met with that day. And so knowing that it is a numbers game is huge. And I think it just like can really take a weight off of the mind of the founder to understand. It's as if, imagine that you're a mid-level engineer again, and you're trying to get a job at one of these 15 companies. You're going to, you know, double your chances of getting a job if it's 30 companies and not 15, right? And it is just like numbers, and it's trying to make sure that you're meeting with the people who are the most likely to like you, to like have that sort of prepared mind about the area that you're building in, but that there are a lot of reasons that someone won't invest that you have no access to know, and you would never know. Like, they signed a Series A last week, and they're kind of only allowed to do one of those a quarter.
Yeah, and there's a huge amount of parallels in between those two cases of you're an individual contributor applying for a job and you're an investor trying, or you're a founder trying to get investment, because in both those cases, the person who is interviewing you and maybe the axe that's rejecting the vast majority of people will see patterns that you don't see. And you hear so many stories both of founders that couldn't raise investment, or they had a bad experience trying to raise, or people trying to get a job and have a bad experience, that are caused by the lack of visibility or lack of context for what is the experience on the other side. Like, someone will be like, I applied to 4 places and none of them hired me, but like, don't they understand? Like, I have this experience, like, which is really good experience. But then what they don't see is like, oh, the way the market is right now, 120 people applied that have equivalent to that experience. And there was only one role. So it's like that, just, they didn't even blink at that.
Companies keep jobs up to like maintain the freshness of their pipeline. And like, there might not even be a job.
Well, investors do too.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Investors take meetings. People don't you should be the one saying this rather than me, but investors take meetings to, they call it deal flow. They meet people that are founders, potential future founders. They want to have an understanding of where the good deals are going to come from. And just because someone talked to you does not mean they're like, okay, I have some money, just like say the magic word or hit this bar and here it
exactly.
is.
Exactly. Yeah. And that sort of like brings us, I think, to another thing that will often kind of blow the mind of a founder, is gauging what kind of a meeting did I just have? You know,
yeah.
It's like, man, they're the same. You know, when you're going out pitching, you know, there's between 1 and 3 people in that first meeting, and they do a little bit about their background and the firm. You do a little bit about yours. You pitch the idea. You go through your sort of like basic thing. And what happens next is actually a huge fork in the road where if you're actually out fundraising, and it's not just like meeting people or like this sort of like socializing. If you're actually like running a fundraising process and you don't hear back the next day, it's a pass.
Right.
If they're interested in the space and in you seriously as a founder, they have probably already met with your competitors. That's the other thing people should know. It's like if someone is looking at, you know, podcasting tools, they're going to go meet with every podcasting tool that will take a meeting with them. Hmm. Not because they're necessarily interested in investing, but also they might want to see like, hey, do I think that there's a market here? And can I find the best team? Because that's what venture is, you know, the
yeah.
power law. It's not about investing in the second or third best company. It's about finding the outlier who's building something incredible that you want to get access to. So yeah, if you've met with them and they haven't reached back out to you in like a day, tops 3 days, it's a pass. And they're never gonna actually pass. It's very unlikely.
This is a sort of infamous dynamic with investors, is that they don't want to pass. Like they will say, oh, it's really interesting, but maybe get in touch again when this milestone happens, or they'll just ghost you, or they don't want to close a door just in case.
Yeah.
It turns out later down the road that you are.
Or it wasn't a serious meeting and they forgot.
Yeah.
You know, like that really like.
Because they had 8 meetings and it wasn't in the top 4 most important ones
exactly.
to them based on
exactly.
their, which is, you know, very much that axe and tree thing. Like.
And then there's the, oh, like, why did they meet with me? Or then, okay, well, then why did they, you know, meet with me a second time? Or they seemed so interested and excited and then I didn't hear from them. And I actually learned this from a VC while I was a VC. He was at a different firm. And he said that his firm's mindset around those moments is that they want to earn the right to say no.
They want to earn the right to say no.
And that really blew my mind. So they are a firm that really, the whole firm comes together. They push to win the deal because in venture, the only thing that matters is that you won, because it is it's a transaction. You're swiping your LP's credit card and you're buying 20% of this Series A company at a certain price. And you could do nothing for the next 8 years and make $500 million. And it actually doesn't matter if they helped you hire your CSO and your CFO and your CTO and scale the board and introduce you to an important company. Actually, for them to make money for their LPs, the only thing that matters, because you can't like retract on that deal is that they want it in the first place. And so they want to be very leaned in order to have the right to have a choice about whether they say yes or no to you. And so it's like earning the right to pass on you. First, you have to be leaned back into them. So they're going to turn up the charm as their sort of like first foray into their win motion. And they win a lot because it works.
I would say something about capitalism, but like capital is right in the name of venture capital. So
yeah. Yeah, it's not subtle.
It's on the tin.
Yeah, and it's a great and very specific tool. And I think the specificity of that tool is the other thing that especially as like, you know, the HBO show Silicon Valley is out there, you know, famous actors have actually like well-performing venture funds. The Chainsmokers have actually, you know, the EDM band, yeah, actually made great investments. It's like, oh, dang, like this has become part of the kind of popular knowledge, especially in the ascendance of tech, that like people think of like, oh, if you want to start a company, you should raise venture capital. But the truth is that very few companies, markets, products are venture ready or a good fit for venture. And so that's like the other thing is, hey, if you're building something that's, let's take a Notes app. Is a Notes app that like you built a beautiful version of with your friends and you got it up to 500K revenue in 18 months. And it feels great because that's a lot of money and your burn
impressive.
Is really low. That's actually probably not a venture backable product, even though, yes, you have seen Notes apps raise venture capital, but you haven't seen like venture capital level, like big exits for a Notes app.
Right. And that's another one of those things where a lot of founders, especially early on, have a lot of frustration when they don't yet understand the mental model or the mechanics of what VC's job is, which I think is better understood now than it was 5 or 10 years ago. But this yeah. model gets simplified down to, and I wonder if this is on your map, of the goal of the VC is to find $1 billion investments. You know, obviously around, there's some number variance and that number, whether it's exactly 1.00 billion.
Yeah.
But when you're like, hey, this could be a $100 million company, at least my mental models of VCs are like, okay, cool. Well, have fun with that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, that's huge. You know, if you build as a founder, and especially because you didn't raise venture capital, you own 90% of like a $100 million company, that is an incredible and life-changing amount. And honestly, so is a $10 million outcome when you own like $9 million or whatever. That's huge. And so that it's just the scale difference. Like they're making money for the Church of England and Harvard, you know, yeah. It's very different than like changing the life of 100 people.
Yeah. And so you have this frustrating, and I don't know if you have anything on the Marauders map on this, but this like valley of death that's huge in between like bootstrappable startups where one or two people yeah. can get the thing going and pay their own salaries and, you know, pursue those $10 million companies. And then you have the $1 billion opportunities where it's like, hey, we have a plausible path to build a $1 billion company. And so you can make a path towards raising investment. There's a really large gap between 10 million and 1 billion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you can get caught in, it's funny, the term that I hear the most often for that valley of death, which I also like, is zombie companies. When you have, and especially during the ZIRP era, zero interest mm-hmm. rate era, you know, people have been able to fairly easily, like, you know, I won't offend the 95% of founders who have like a hell of a time raising money, like easily raise, you know, $100 million. And then they're at $1 million in revenue or even $25 million in revenue, but their valuation is $2 billion. Like, you know, it's enough revenue that everyone is still kind of like committed and it seems like it's working. Because again, for normal people, $25 million is a huge amount of money. But from like the lens of these like outlier scale, venture scale companies, it's really not. In fact, especially in SaaS, a lot of companies really stall out between 20 and 50. And if you don't kind of power through the 20 to 50 ARR range, you can be stuck there grinding it out between 35 and 45 for quite a while. And then you've closed off a bunch of exits because you raised too much money at too high of a valuation, but it's also like kind of working. And it would be incredible if you had done, you know, the Basecamp model and you're making that much money, but you didn't. You raised venture capital. And so it's very, you know, it's without the Marauder's Map, how would you know?
Yeah.
Because like no one tells you this. And everyone, of course, thinks if you have the self-confidence to start a company, not 100% of every day, but enough hours in the day you spend being, yeah, I'm gonna win. Like people don't understand. I am an outlier, you know, because it's that confidence that leads you to starting a company in the first place.
Yeah, and while there is, it's a really intuitive psychology. It's not just, you know, understandable, but it's totally appropriate to be excited about an idea as a founder, especially you're like a first-time founder, you haven't had a big exit. You're like, I see a path to this being a company that could be worth tens or maybe even hundreds of millions of dollars, and I founded it, and like I'm seeing traction. It's just like, of course you're excited. Of course you would think like the world should be like, it would, in an ideal, if we were to design capitalism from scratch again, then like it would be possible to fund those kind of companies without having to go to some of the more contorted measures that we do sometimes to try to fund those kind of companies, which I would be kind of interested to click in on funding that kind of company, but I would rather use the time we have left to chat a little bit about Panobi, because we've talked about growth teams, and then we talked about the VC. We're actually going in the, your sort of career progress and the your current stage as your billions company Panobi. And I know it's, you know, relatively early. It's not $1 billion yet, as far as I know. But
I am convinced.
But you're convinced, and you convinced some VCs that this is the path. There's an opportunity here, and I find it really interesting because it's in this form of there's this need that didn't exist 10 years ago, which is we have these growth teams now, and it's a model for building businesses, building products, and you're building tools based on what you've learned and what we're learning as an industry to kind of support this process. So I'd be curious to hear a bit from you about sort of how you're kind of approaching this space and kind of what you've been learning so far digging into it.
I'm obviously like so obsessed with this. And in part, it is because I have had, you know, so many lucky breaks and this incredible opportunity to be a VC, to be a founder, to be a head of growth, to be an ICPM and a game designer. And so in my speed run of like multi-classing the Silicon Valley RPG, I have, you know, gotten this vantage point from these moments of understanding that, okay, at the IC individual contributor level, you have marketers and product managers who are trying to tell stories with data, trying to make decisions with data. And in order to do that, what they're actually spending all their GD time doing is going over to a dashboard and taking a screenshot of it and then going into a spreadsheet and copy-pasting some rows out of it and bringing all of that together in like a Google Doc or a Notion page or a slide somewhere. And then that IC sends it to their lead, the head of growth, let's say. The head of growth takes those from all of her PMs and marketers. And I used to do this. And it took me a single day, in an entire day in a work week to do this process of taking like this from this person and this from this person and this from this person. And then to go in and get like some company level data and do that thing again. And then I pass it up to the CEO. And then him and his team are weaving that into the board deck. And so then, as you know, having speedrun Silicon Valley, I now see like, oh man, and it was like not a long time ago for me because it has been a speedrun. But you know, 15 years ago when I started my career, maybe even just like 12 years ago, we were using Google Docs and slides, and it was very similar tooling. And the sort of data tooling landscape is even more fragmented now than it was then. And it's even more important, especially in our new sort of like macroeconomic reality, to do things efficiently and to be able to back up what you're doing with data so that you can go to, frankly, the CFO and say, hey, dude, I can take the dollar that you give me and make us $1.50 on the other side of it.
One of the, not having seen the product gap, but one of the things that makes me curious about what you're describing is this horrible process that anyone who's worked at a company, at least in leadership, has probably seen of people farming spreadsheets and trying to assemble data and it spreading it into a pyramid and it getting baked into decks and stuff, is that you have the dreaded, like, once a couple layers up, you have somebody being like, how exactly is this number calculated? Like, exactly. What exactly goes into it? And then it's like, someone's like,
no,
I'll get back to you on
the
that.
The death knell of the meeting. Oh my gosh, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And even the, like, the sort of, like, more positive version of, like, the metrics fight, let's define what the word is, that happens in this level of meeting, is also just like the lack of flexibility to lean into where the executive team is on that day that you're presenting to them. Mm-hmm. So when I was head of growth at Slack, I would work very closely with my head of data and with the head of growth marketing, Rachel Hepworth, who's now the CMO at Notion.
Nice.
Which I just keep saying because I am so proud. She's such a And so, you know, the three of us would work together over the course of like 2 weeks, you know, putting together this report that we called, you know, the Growth Council. We were presenting to the Growth Council. We put together the slide deck. And it was, you know, some of it was like, here are our top line metrics and what we're doing against them. But also, here's something that we see coming in the future that we want to raise up to the executive level to sort of like get around it. But we're coming from down here, and they're coming from a more strategic layer in the company, and they have, you know, much more data and sort of levels of input, so they'll have this like sort of different point of view. And it was unfortunately often the case that we'd walk into this and we would have an okay but not great meeting that was a great use of people's time because they wanted to go in some other direction.
Yeah.
Oh, I know you're looking at you know, the revenue forecast that you put together for the PLG, you know, paid conversion focus that we have for next quarter. But we're looking at, you know, XYZ on marketing. And then it's like, oh, well, shit. Like, what we have is like all of this pre-computed data in a static thing that we spend a lot of time making. We don't have the flexibility to just like turn a page in a place where actually all of that data is live. So when I tell people about Panobi, I often, you know, relay those stories and say like, hey, if you could cut off that, you know, metrics definition fight by literally just like opening up the metric that you're looking at and showing them the SQL query, because we are, you know, kind of a tool. Imagine if like, you know, Notion, you could write SQL in it and you could pull in data from, you know, Snowflake and Google Analytics, as well as some pre-computed CSV that your data scientists work on. And you can sort of see what went into all of those, what the data source was, how fresh the data was. But then you can also see it next to all of the projects that not just your product team is shipping, but that your performance marketing team is shipping and your brand marketing team is shipping. It's funny. It's a new thing. And I know everyone, I mean, I'm like a basic founder in many ways. I'm like convinced that this is some brilliant new thing that everyone will be using. And it's a new category. You know, I'll just own the fact that like, this is typical as hell to think that I'm special and that what we're building is really incredible. But I do think that that's the case because we are bringing together all of these things that are hard to get access to. And it's very hard to sort of create this, like this source of truth. And we're just sort of willing to do the unreasonable slog that it has taken us over the last like 18 months to build a product where we can really quickly build native integrations to all of these data sources and present it in a really intuitive and lovely product interface that people want to use.
Yeah, 10 years ago, if you'd asked me about building a startup as a founder where there's this big slog to build a difficult thing, I would be like, yeah, maybe you don't want to do that. But I was convinced. You know, I've heard this idea before, but I think it was Dennis Pellerinos, who I believe is an investor in Panobi. Is that true?
Yeah, and a friend. He's the best.
And he flipped my mind on this. I'm working through Buddy Build when we had an early conversation where he was like, oh, I think we should do this, and we're going to orchestrate Xcode in the cloud to sign iPhone apps and do other things. I'm like, that's going to be horrible. It's going to be so much work, and it's going to be hard to keep running, and you're going to have Max in the cloud, and like, you don't want to do this. And then instead of being discouraged, he was energized, and he was just like, yeah. Oh, it's hard, great. Then we won't have, like, we'll have a moat, and it's going to take a long time for anyone to catch up to us. And I was like, all right, your funeral. And then, like, of course, he had this, like, exit, and like, it was great.
Yeah.
He was right and I was wrong. And that's flipped my mind now. I have a much different emotional relationship when either in my own work or I hear a founder saying like, okay, well, there's this opportunity, but it seems really hard to actually like make it work in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, I like it.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny, you know, often young founders that are coming out of a program like YC or Y Combinator will approach angel investors like me. And of course, like they're first-time founders, and they'll say something to the effect of, hey, the three of us built this in 2 months.
Mm.
And they say that, meaning we put so much effort into this. It was difficult, but we got it done. We're so happy that we were able to do it so quickly. Isn't that impressive? What I hear is any three people can build this in 2 months.
Yeah.
Like 2 months is almost no time for something as hard as like solving a technical problem or even like figuring out like how to build a really great product. It's like some things actually just take a lot more time and a lot more determination than the average bear is willing to put into a project.
Yeah, well, and that's why we have our Marauders map and the ability to sometimes, if you're lucky and you read it correctly, get the capital to go take the big swing and build the thing and find out if you're right.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, this has been a great conversation. I appreciate you so much for making the time. Where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
We are at Panobi, PANOBI.com. Swing by. You can book a demo. The demos are with me. It's a link to my Calendly. So if you want to talk, I'm just a click away.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being on the show. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. And that's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. Until next time, keep shipping.